Jerome Corsi, PhD, a political scientist, is the author of Black Gold Stranglehold, Myth of Scarcity and Politics of Oil.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And I want to say a couple things before getting started. One is, the book is there out on the table, and I'll stay and sign books. If anyone has one or any of my books that they bought previously, I'm going to stay with you through lunch until probably about 4 o'clock. I give another speech tonight, a three-hour speech from 7 to 10, but I don't have to be over there until a little bit later. So I've got two speeches today, and I want to stay with you. I've enjoyed the first speakers that I've heard. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. When I wrote Black Gold Stranglehold, I want to tell you how it came about. And probably characterizing me as a professional troublemaker is not too far off, and probably has always been the case, even when I was a kid. I got into this subject as a kid, in the 50s. I was born in 1946, and I was a truant from school, even from kindergarten. I refused to attend. But I did have a habit of going and reading all the books in the library, even from the time I was about 5 years old. And I want to make two points about that. One is I remember distinctly, and I can see the article today, in the 50s, there was just this little science magazine notice that of curiosity that the Soviets were finding oil at several thousand meters below the surface of the Earth. And I read that, and I thought, well, if that's the case, oil can't have anything to do with dinosaurs, because there's no dinosaurs down there, never was. So I went home and told my dad, and he said, shut up, kid, I don't know. My dad was a highly intelligent guy. He was the public relations director for the Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen, union man, and he helped to create the United Transportation Union. So I grew up in that family, and my dad and I almost never agreed about politics. I think the only thing that I ever did agree with him on politics solidly was when they supported Jack Kennedy, because as a kid I supported Jack Kennedy as well. My father graduated from Case Western Reserve, where I later graduated. It was Western Reserve in 1954 when he graduated on the GI Bill of Rights. He had been in the Army Air Corps. And I also had read all of his college books. And I resolved in doing that. I came home one day. He came home. And I told him I was never going to take a course in science. I asked him if they really did teach this stuff in college like this. And he said, yes, they did. And I said, well, that's it. I'm not taking it. And he said, why? I said, well, it's all wrong. There's nothing in here that makes any sense at all. And I'd read his geology books. I'd read his chemistry books. He had a physics book. I read them all. And I wasn't going to take any of them. And quite frankly, I never did. I went through college taking the minimum. I taught statistics at the University of Denver at the university level. I never took a course in statistics. I did research with the National Science Foundation when I was in universities, and I was in universities for about 10 years. I conducted randomized field experiments. We demonstrated you could hold fair hearings by telephone instead of in person, and that is now, in fact, for unemployment insurance and welfare and many other types of insurance, of those kinds of social programs. You can have either a telephone hearing or an in-person hearing. And we demonstrated that in a randomized field experiment that I ran for 4 years in Colorado and in New Mexico. And I never took a course in field experimentation either. I refused at Harvard. I went to Harvard, in fact, because they didn't teach any science in their political science. I think at Harvard they barely knew how to use a computer when I was there. At any rate, so I came to this question as a kid, as a contrarian, and I'm still there. And now that I'm writing full-time, I'm trying to demonstrate that oil most likely has nothing to do with biological products whatsoever. I'm going to take a little bit more extreme position than the speaker previously. And I'm going to start with that, and I do a lot of radio for the books I write, and I have to learn to convey these concepts to a general public. So I'm first going to give you a little bit of the science of why it's the case, and then I'm going to tell you how I explain it to people. I want to make sure first you understand what the real theory that's been the predominant theory from the petrogeologists for it started in 1757 with a Russian named Lamaninov, and he knew that there was biological product being found, biological debris found in oil. So committing this fallacy of causation, he argued that the oil had to have been created by biological products. And that idea caught on. It's fossil fuel because Lamaninov said it came from dinosaurs. That's why we call it fossil fuel. Okay, now, Mendeleev, as was mentioned earlier, who designed the periodic chart in chemistry, said nonsense. And this was, you know, shortly after Lamaninov did this theory. Mendeleev said it had been working, and he knew that hydrogens and carbons formed naturally, and he'd been studying that, and he rejected the theory. But that never caught on. What caught on was that oil comes from biological debris. Okay, and the culprits were thought to be dinosaurs, then maybe ancient forests, and recently the petrogeologists will settle for anything. They'll settle for microbes, plankton, anything that's biological. Now, the idea here is that the rock, the sedimentary rock, contains biological debris because living critters were on that rock. Then they died, got buried, became part of evidently first the sedimentary soil, and then as it hardened, metamorphized, or whatever, they became embedded as biological material in that rock. Then the petrogeologists, and they have an elaborate theory on this, which I'm going to maintain today is all fiction and nonsense. In fact, it's actually pretty silly. They believe that the rock, under great pressure, the biological material, as it were, cooks. It turns into what they call kerogen. Kerogen is supposed to be like this kind of swamp material. You know, that's part of one of the reasons I think people psychologically make this identification is swampy stuff kind of looks like oil. So they think that all this biological gook, you know, turned into some kind of kerogen like fly juice. And over time, as it heated up and was under great pressure, then that kerogen evolved into hydrocarbon forms that we now know as oil and other hydrocarbons. Now, that's all nonsense. First of all, they identify these as source rocks. In other words, a petrogeologist, and they have complex biomarkers that they identify by chemical properties and relate to source rocks. In other words, it's the idea that this particular limestone of this epoch contained these critters, and they cooked into this kind of oil and stayed trapped in the rock. Okay, now that's the idea. Now, it does violate the second law of thermodynamics, because the second law of thermodynamics, simply understood, is if you got a balloon full of air and you release the air, it goes out. Yeah, highly concentrated energy disperses. And to put it back in the balloon, which is not going to do naturally, you got to have some other pressure that forces it back into the balloon. So in other words, the second law of thermodynamics would say that biological material does not deteriorate into a higher form of hydrocarbon. It deteriorates into a lesser one. Okay, so when I get on the radio, I tell people things like, I say, I've buried a lot of people in my life. And I don't recall ever talking to a mortician about lining the casket, because Aunt Matilda was going to turn into diesel fuel number two. You know, in the Bible, it does not say, you know, dust into oil. It says dust into dust. Well, there's a very good reason for that. Another thing I'll tell them is I say, look, you know, I had a cat when I was 9 years old. It died, got run over by a car, and I scraped it up off the pavement and buried it in the backyard. Well, you know, a few years later, I wanted to see what happened to the cat, and I dug it up. Well, there's no oil. A few bones, a little fur. I say, if I had a pile of 100 cats and I buried them real deep, I doubt there'd be any oil there either, because cats don't turn into oil. They turn into constituent chemicals, and they go back into the earth as constituent chemicals. Okay, now, there's another great scientific fallacy here that I've been amused at since I was a child also, and that is the distinction between organic and inorganic chemistry. You know, we have organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry. That's because in organic chemistry, they believe that all of the chemicals there are from biological life, constituent chemicals of biological life. And they believed initially, going back into the 1700s again, that there were some distinguishing characteristic about organic chemicals that distinguish them from inorganic chemicals, that the organic chemicals somehow had the essence of life in them, and inorganic chemicals did not. Okay, now, that's also nonsense. I mean, Wohler, a German chemist in 1820, took some ammonian basic elements, and he was trying to make an ammonium compound, and what he ended up with was urea. Well, urea is the primary, can be basically boiled down from urine, which is a biological product. And if Wohler could make a biological product out of inorganic chemicals, which is all he was working with, it disputed that there was any distinction between organic and inorganic chemicals. The truth is, all chemicals are inorganic. They can almost all be found somewhere in the earth that's not living. They can be synthesized. From the vast majority of compounds that we work with can be synthesized and can be made in other ways than produced from a living being. Yet today, inorganic chemistry is left to the study of hydrocarbons because of this original idea that hydrocarbons came from living materials. And that has stayed into our colleges and universities today. The truth is, you could take the constituent chemicals that constitute our body, and I'm quite convinced science at some point or other could figure out how to find them somewhere, not living, put them in the right context, create a body that was entirely like ours, and I doubt it would live. Because I think the distinction is not that there are biologically motivated chemicals that contain the seed of life, but I'm still willing to believe that's God, and that's the distinction between living and non-living things, and it's not found in the distinction between the chemicals. Now, of course, in science, I'd probably get an F right now at Harvard in a science course, because you're not allowed to mention God. And B, they're on the path to find everything can be created naturally and made to be here just by putting it together in the right order. And I think that's nonsense. Now, there are increasing proofs that oil is a natural product of the earth made on a continuous basis, as the Russians and as Thomas Gold said, produced deep within the mantle of the earth. I'm going to give you some examples. We've just had a probe that landed on Titan. NASA sent a probe and it landed on Titan, which is the giant moon of Saturn. Okay, now on Titan, Titan is full of methane. Hydrocarbons abound in Titan. And NASA came out and did declare about 6 months ago that their tests showed it was carbon-14 methane. Methane's a very simple chain, one carbon plus four hydrogen combined to make a molecule of methane. Simple chain. And it's produced abundantly in on Titan and is carbon-14, which is abiotic. Scientists have come to the conclusion they're not going to get and identify carbon-14 from biological materials. That's not the carbon-12, yes, carbon-11, carbon-13, yes, 12 and 13, but not 14. Okay, so NASA declared that the methane on Titan is abiotic. And I guess their alternative was to say there are little dinosaurs on Titan that made it. You know, or there was some living thing on Titan that made it. From deep within the Earth, there's a crack in the mid-Atlantic, which no one knows why it's there, right in the middle of the Atlantic. And what bubbles up from that crack is methane. It naturally bubbles up from deep within the Earth. And that's carbon-14. So we've got some very concrete evidence. Also, some scientists, a group at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory about 2 years ago, took some very simple chemicals. They took iron oxide. They took calcite, there's calcite that's inorganic calcite, which is what they used, not just limestone, which is typically organic, and water. And under high pressure, in a diamond anvil, they were able to observe it. They squeezed it together, high pressure. They created methane. And they did not throw in any microbes to make sure they had a biological constituent. That's similar to Wohler synthesizing urea. Okay, so in other words, methane can form naturally. And it does so all over the world. Hydrogen and carbon do not need the benefit of a dead dinosaur to come together. There are abundant chemical constituents on Earth and in our solar system. There are two of the four most common elements here on Earth, and they combine on their own. Now, it's like men and women don't need dead dinosaurs to get together. Well, neither does carbon and hydrogen. They naturally form together. Now, the idea that we had to find source rock has been known for a long time, that you can produce oil in many different ways. The Nazis had abundant coal, but they had no oil. Well, they spent years and huge amount of money. We captured the documents after the war, and it became part of our science, the Fischer-Tropsch process, which was mentioned earlier. And what they learned is they could take coal and they could take a catalyst like iron oxide, and they could produce petroleum and diesel fuel out of the coal very easily. And they had abundant Fischer-Tropsch oil. In beating the Nazis, there was a strategic bombing study, which I refer to in Black Gold Stranglehold, that was done at the end of the war. Franklin Roosevelt, before the war ended, had the intelligence to ask, we've done all this bombing, did it do any good? Well, a large part of the answer was no. We bombed the German factories that were producing Messerschmitts, and they just dispersed the factory, got the machinery recovered out of the bombed out buildings. At the end of the war, the Germans were building more Messerschmitts and tanks than at the beginning of the war, even though we'd bombed all their factories repeatedly. When we bombed civilian centers, it just made the people mad and convinced them that we were barbaric and they wanted to fight us harder. The only bombing that we did that was any good was we bombed Hitler's chemical plants. And we bombed oil fields like Polesti that he had gotten and was using in Eastern Europe. Hitler ran out of oil. He had lots of tanks. He had lots of Messerschmitts. He had good inventions coming on. He had no oil. He couldn't run the tanks. But he had the Fischer-Tropsch process. And the truth is, you can produce oil or methane or, I mean, methane, is, if any of you ever as kids or as adults on a farm, you know not to go into a barn full of cows in the morning and light a cigarette. You'll blow the barn up. There's more methane in there than you could imagine. And the methane comes from the cows. It's a naturally producing product of the cows. Methane can be produced by biological agents, but again, it doesn't mean that it has to have biological agents to produce it. You can take almost any substance. You can take sewage. You can take turkey parts. You can take almost anything you can think of, and you can ferment it in well-understood processes and distill it and end up with oil. The process to produce ethanol from corn has been understood for decades, for a long time. The problem with it is it's too expensive. We actually use more hydrocarbons to produce ethanol than it's worth, than we save. If ethanol weren't supported by our recent energy bills to the tune of about $5 billion a year, the entire industry would collapse. It's not an efficient fuel. It uses too much hydrocarbons by the time you irrigate and you grow the corn, harvest the corn, take it to the factory, and ethanol does not travel as well as oil does or gasoline, and it doesn't get as many miles. So you end up using more. Countries like Brazil converted to ethanol, and they found ways to produce it relatively efficiently. But even in Brazil, it's not considered to be a primary kind of fuel. So the processes of synthetically creating oil and natural gas are well understood. And it has nothing to do, step 13 in none of these formulas says call in, throwing in some dead dinosaur parts. There's no dead cats. There's no biological material needed whatsoever. The problem is that oil, when it does seep up from being created within the earth, pools in sedimentary rock. And along the process, it picks up biological debris. In fact, oil, biological critters, where there is no light, and Thomas Gould argued this, can live without photosynthesis on the oil itself as their primary nutrient. So oil is a natural product to be filled with biological debris that has nothing to do with its causation. Okay, I also say on the radio, just so people get their minds around it and really understand how silly this idea is, I say it is not the case that at the end of the Mesozoic age, the Mesozoic era, all the dinosaurs herded to Saudi Arabia and died in a pile. And that's why we have oil in Saudi Arabia, because they died there in a pile like elephants. You know, elephants, they got to go to the happy hunting ground and all die together in the burial ground. So dinosaurs knew, well, big comet going to hit here. We better get to Saudi Arabia. Didn't happen that way. China, no oil is found. China's getting their oil now from Iran. You mean to tell me that all that sedimentary rock and metamorphic rock and everything else in China is so fundamentally different from the rock in Iran or the rock here in that it contained no biological material? Nonsense. I've done studies and show them in Black Gold Stranglehold. We talk about it. You won't hear about this much, but the bedrock under Saudi Arabia is deeply fractured. And if you take the fault lines of the fractures on the biological studies and map the oil fields are right on top of the fracture lines. Okay, the giant comet that did hit at the end of the Mesozoic age and is currently the reason the dinosaurs were considered to have been extinguished hit in the Yucatan. Okay, now that comet, when it hit, deeply fractured the entire bed of the Gulf of Mexico. And the major Gulf oil find from Mexico was found And Cantarell is the name of the field. Well, Cantarell was a fisherman. He was out there in a boat, and he saw the oil bubbling up in the Gulf. And he thought there was a sunken boat down there that the oil was escaping from. They found out and they figured out that that oil was coming from a deep reservoir of oil within the Yucatan that was related to the fracture lines from the comet. They've just found a second field in the Gulf. In fact, our technology now has advanced to the point where deep earth drilling is the fastest growing part of the oil industry. And the rigs offshore are getting results, not because oil is uniquely available there and not elsewhere, but, you know, there's a nice thing about drilling for oil under a big pile of water is you get to go down through all the water first without any drilling. So you can be 5, 6, 7 miles down and only have drilled 3. And they're finding huge amounts of oil at those levels, all through the Gulf of Mexico. The restrictions, however, are political. We do not want that oil drilled because it might have a spill and hurt the beaches or the Gulf, Louisiana. And so we don't permit it, or Florida. Well, you know, we've just allowed Jimmy Carter and his eminent brilliance had given away a great part of the rights to the Gulf of Mexico to Cuba. And Cuba's just announced that they've gotten together with Communist China, and they're going to drill for oil 45 miles off Key West. Of course, our laws prevent us from doing that. But Communist China and Cuba are going to go after it. And I'm willing to say they're going to find a huge quantity of oil. Now, it is a political idea that becomes political because you've heard peak oil. We're running out of oil. It's embedded in the idea. There are only so many dinosaurs, so there can only be so much oil. Only so many dead ancient forests, only so much oil. It's limited. We're going to run out. Well, again, this is nonsense. It was developed by a guy named Hubert, drew a peak like a mountain graph, normal distribution. He said, we're not going to have very much oil. We're going to be using a lot of oil. Then it's going to be gone. We're going to be using it all. It's going to be gone. He did that in 1956. He worked for Shell Oil. Problem is, that graph's never been right. And they've had to adjust it over and over and over again to show that, yes, we're still running out, but it's going to take a while longer. Okay, they do not understand that the basic design of that theory is fundamentally flawed. People make the fallacy of composition. They think because they got a swimming pool and they drain all the water of it, the water's gone, that swimming pool is never going to have any water back in it. Okay, well, oil in the earth doesn't work that way. It does refill, and even if it doesn't refill so fast, there's a hugely amount, there's so much of it available that we didn't need that swimming pool, because right next to it, we got 6 others. Today, according to the Energy Information Institute, there's 1.28 trillion barrels of oil in proven reserves. That's more than ever in human history, despite the fact that since 1970, worldwide consumption of oil has doubled. That doesn't sound like we're running out. And that's been consistently the case since the 50s when Hubert, you know, this brilliant oil guy, drew this wonderful peak oil chart on the back of a napkin at lunch one day at Shell Oil. It's nonsense. It's junk science. We're finding new oil all the time, all over the world, and at deep levels. We're awash in oil. Iran just increased by 25% their estimates of reserves. Afghanistan just announced they'd found oil. None was expected to be there. Kazakhstan, all those stands, abundant in oil and natural gas. Even in the continental United States, go to the U.S. Department of Energy's website, and of course under fossil fuel, which is where they put oil, you know, the dinosaur section, They have a project called Deep Track, in which they're encouraging drillers to go down 3 miles or more below the surface of the continental United States, because they've demonstrated there are giant pools of methane awaiting there to be tapped. Now, I want to take exception with one thing that the previous speaker said, and that is I disagree that Thomas Gold was a plagiarist. Thomas Gold, I can see the book right now and I can read the footnotes in my mind. He footnoted the Russians. Jack Kenny likes to tell people he was a plagiarist. Jack Kenny thinks everybody's a plagiarist. There's a lot of jealousy and competition in this theory as to who owns the abiotic theory of oil. I, quite frankly, don't claim to own it. But also, I want to tell you who Thomas Gold was. Thomas Gold was an astrophysicist. Now, he came out of Vienna. He was born in Vienna, and he came out before World War II, and he got himself to London, and they didn't know what to do with him. They put him in a camp for a year to figure out if he was a spy of Hitler. Well, Thomas Gold said, would you guys mind if I helped you with radar? Because his specialty was radio. He understood deeply radio waves. And he worked and helped before and during the war the British perfect radar. And we all know how that was critically important to the British being able to handle the Battle of Britain when they were being bombed every night. At least they knew where the planes were coming and when they were going to be there for the Spitfires to get into the air. Thomas Gold, when he got to the United States, was responsible throughout his career for other pretty startling discoveries. He was the first guy to say that pulsars existed and to explain them, that they were these kind of dark inward stars burning inward that emitted radio waves. He did experiments with the ear. It always fascinated scientists. They could not understand how the human ear could take sounds and make them heard with all the range and depth that we truly hear in. And Gold said, well, there's little hairs in there, and the way they vibrate in relationship to the frequencies of the sound waves is able to be detected and translated by the brain as sound. Well, he, about 25 years later, turned out he was right. And that today is the prevailing theory. How Gold got onto this theory had nothing to do with stealing it from the Russians, I'm sorry. Gold was a radio spectrographer. And he had been studying the radio spectrographs from the planets and the moons in our solar system. And what he realized as a radio spectrographer was that he was reading hydrocarbon signatures all over our solar system. It was abundant. Everywhere he looked, he was getting these spectrographs which said there was hydrocarbons in there and of all different forms. And so Gold said, doesn't have anything to do with dinosaurs, unless they were on Titan. And he came to the conclusion. Then he found the Russian theory. He articulated it and footnoted it. And he footnoted Kenny, too. Also, then what Gold did is he advanced it. Because Gold advanced it by arguing some of the deep earth issues that just today some of the Ukrainian scientists that have been communicating with me since I wrote this book are beginning to look at and say that Gold was right. Gold showed that the processes within the mantle of the Earth, which we don't know very much about, were of such a nature that not only did hydrogen and carbon combine, but there were other chemicals around like iron sulfide, so that Fischer-Tropsch type reactions were taking place naturally within the mantle of the Earth. And the advanced hydrocarbon forms, including those that combine with naphthol and form chains, which we identify as various forms of petroleum, are all natural processes of the deep Earth. And he also showed that even within the deep Earth, it's biologically active. It's not just that living things exist on the surface of this planet from photosynthesis. There's bacteria and small critters living where the sun has never shined, deep within the earth, at the bottom of the oceans, and we're just now beginning to get the science that validates that. To get a perspective on how primitive our science is in these issues, I want to make a couple points. When we trained the Apollo astronauts to land on the moon, does anybody know what we trained them that the craters on the moon were caused by? We trained them that those were from volcanoes. Okay? Well, there's never been any evidence that there ever was a volcano on the moon. Our scientists could not accept that those were meteorite impacts because it's just too disturbing. If that could happen on the moon and it was just pocked all that like that, why didn't it happen here? Well, it took a geologist, a guy named Shoemaker, and he did this in the 60s. Didn't get established science until about 5 years ago. They did not know that the great crater out in Arizona was a meteor impact. That was not established in science. Shoemaker established it. In fact, Shoemaker said, there's meteor impacts all over the Earth, just like there is in the moon. The thing is, the Earth heals better. It covers them over. It grows vegetation. He went and he found the trace elements that are attributable to meteors, even built into cathedrals in Europe, because they used that material to build cathedrals out of, not knowing that it was produced from the meteors hitting. He did the first studies of the iridium, which is one of the elements you find in the giant geological ground that indicates the giant meteor hit somewhere. Now, I also wrote about this global warming, and I want to make this point on that. You know, I'll go back to when I was a kid. 1954, my dad took us for a ride. We went to Florida on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. It was one of the first opened in the United States. I'd never seen a turnpike before. When they cut that turnpike through, they went through a lot of bedrock to open it up. A lot of sedimentary rock, a lot of metamorphic rock. And I remember driving along it. It was the first time in my life I'd ever seen rock strata. And I was fascinated. And I saw how it was, you know, yellow for here, and then it changed, and it was, you know, more of a burned red color. So I asked my dad, how'd that happen? And he said, oh, well, you know, son, there's these great periods of change. They go along, and it's stable, and then, you know, it's just gradual, and eventually it turns into another form because, like, the weather changes. I said, well, Dad, I understand all that, but that's not what I asked you. He said, well, what'd you ask? I said, I don't want you to talk about all that yellow part or all that red part. I want to talk about that line right there where it changed. Because it doesn't look to me like that took any long period of time. It was yellow up to here, then suddenly it's burnt red. What happened? Well, I got another one of the shut up kid answers on that as well. And he was probably right. I think nobody knew. And I think today nobody knows. We like to think of the Earth as a stable planet. We like to think that the dinosaurs were the only ones who were extinct. There's probably been 190 extinctions on this planet where more than 90% of all the species living on the planet at that time were gone. Didn't happen just once. It's happened over and over and over again. So many times that nobody's really counted them all or had any idea what happened that changed those periods. But I guarantee you something happened, whether it was a meteor hitting or some other thing, something happened. This is not a stable planet. I mean, how could it be? It's spinning around, it's changing all the time. You know, it's not even round, it's elliptical. And the poles change, and the magnetic spheres change. There's so many changes going on in the Earth, I don't think our scientists are aware of what the real ones are, because they haven't figured out how to measure them yet. Now, I wrote about the biological, you know, the global warming in this book because I'm saying to people, well, use the oil. And I'm going to conclude this by telling you the science on that. But I want to make this point. the changes that go on in the Earth are constant. Now, is the Earth getting warmer? Yes. What's my proof of that? Well, I don't see any mastodons around anymore. Great Lakes aren't covered with glaciers. A lot warmer than then. You know, when I taught statistics, I taught, as was mentioned earlier, the time series analysis is the most problematic data to analyze because you never know if you're looking at the right period of time. A chart that looks like this doesn't even show that when you look at a longer period of time. I spent 25 years in financial services, and mutual funds have figured this out pretty good. They only show you the little time series where they were the best. They don't show you the few years after where they tanked. Their competitors will show you that maybe, while they're showing you the 2 years they were the best. Now, in terms of the Earth warming, it can't possibly have anything to do with the amount of hydrocarbons we put into the... You know, again, it's a political idea. There are many in the anti-industrialists, you can call them whatever you want, who think it's wrong that we have such an advanced society, don't believe we should burn up hydrocarbons, and really are opposed to people, advancement, and all the other science that we enjoy that gets at our lifestyle. In fact, they think our lifestyle is wrong because we just use up too much of the Earth's resources, and that's immoral. Well, again, I say that's nonsense. The rest of the world ought to use up these resources too. It's because they think the resources are scarce. Now, the idea that the Earth, that we are putting up so many hydrocarbons, so much carbon dioxide that is causing the Earth to warm in a greenhouse effect is nonsense. Grow more trees. Carbon dioxide is not a noxious chemical. Trees love it. The truth is, the Earth has never been more abundant in vegetations, and the truth is we've reforested the United States, despite all the people who'd like you to believe we're just cutting down trees left and right. Even the rainforests are growing and being reestablished. The history of human beings looked at from their use of resources like trees are that when human beings settle in an area, yes, they deforest. That happened in Kansas and Nebraska when it was first settled, and we saw the dust storms as a result of it. The history is after people settle, the next thing they do is plant trees, and it reforests. And with the amount of warmth that's happening in the Earth right now, I've been going to Israel for 25 years. Israel is greener than ever, both because they planted more trees and it's getting warmer. There's more sunlight. Okay, so there are natural solutions to this issue, and the science is not conclusive, as was said earlier. You know, we make a mistake to think we human beings are important. Every time I fly across the United States, like I've done this past week, I look down and I say, nobody living down there. Huge stretches are unoccupied. Human beings live in about 11% of the surface of the Earth. Put all the people, all 6.5 billion together in one place and have them stand comfortably together, you won't fill up three states in New England. Okay, now the science of resources, which are typically ignored in this debate, you know, I guess because I don't buy any of it, and never did, even as a kid. I read all of this stuff and find the guys from one discipline to another discipline who are actually solving the questions, but, you know, the geologists don't read the energy resource economists. It takes a guy like me to read them. So you've got Julian Simon. He passed away a little while ago. He was a brilliant energy resource economist. Now, Julian Simon went back, and he showed that running out of are the way people think of all forms of energy. Julian Simon went back to the books published during the Industrial Revolution in the 1850s in England, and he found volumes that had been bestsellers called Running Out of Coal, because they thought they were going to run out of coal. You know, they were using too much of it. It was going to be all gone. There was only so much coal. Well, Julian Simon went back to the running out of oil, and he found in the United States the USGS saying we're going to run out of oil in the 1800s. We've been going to run out of oil since our government's kept statistics. They keep telling everybody we're running out. And President Bush says we're addicted to oil. Nonsense. Let's use it all up. You can't. What Julian Simon said is the history of energy resources is the following. One, people think they're going to use it all up. Two, it's more abundant than they thought. They hadn't found it all. Three, some of what they find is deeper and more expensive and harder to get, but their technology improves. And they get to be able to recover that economically when before they didn't think they could. And fourth, people diversify energy. So they may start using a lot of coal, but before they're done, they won't be using hardly any at all because they'll have gone to other alternatives that are better. They diversify them. Well, that's exactly what's happening in oil. I got to, though, commend our oil companies. This is the best public relations campaign ever conducted in the history of the world to convince everybody that oil is biological and that we're running out. That's what made them be able to earn $100 billion last year, more than had ever been earned in corporate history in the world. And you all wouldn't have paid that much if you knew how available it was. We haven't built a new refinery in the United States in about 30 years. We've closed them. The capacity's increased at the ones that we have left open. And as a result, we are still refining about the same amount of oil, but the problem is we limit the supply. The oil companies do that intentionally. In fact, today the oil companies fund the environmentalists. And they run commercials like BP that says they're beyond petroleum. Give me a break. BP is no more beyond petroleum than Carter's out of little liver pills. BP is British Petroleum. It's searching for oil everywhere in the world. Everywhere you look, BP is there. There's oil being found everywhere. It's being found off the coast of Africa. There's new oil finds in the North Sea. Oil being found in Scandinavia. Russia's now abundant with oil. We're finding oil all through the Middle East. China's about to find oil. There's oil all around us. Do you know who our major suppliers of oil are today? That's not the Middle East. Our top supplier of oil right now is Canada because we're able to get those tar sands, and they are economically converted, and there's probably enough oil that can come out of those for 200 years, even if we double production use twice more. We use four times as much as we do today. We still won't run out for 200 years. Then that same resource goes down to the oil shale in the Rocky Mountains. Well, we're learning how to get it efficiently. And if that doesn't work, we'll probably figure out how to take the sewage and make it into oil. You can make all these things into oil. But we have plenty from Canada, and we won't allow ourselves to use our own oil shale for political reasons. Second biggest supplier is Mexico. Well, Mexico's getting, I maintained, and I just wrote a book with Jim Gilchrist of the Minutemen. It's called Minutemen, The Battle to Secure America's Borders. And I argued there and also in Black Gold Stranglehold that one of the reasons President Bush does not secure the borders, and he has no intention of it, he's going to create the North American Union. Been writing about that too. Just like the European Union, get ready for a new government. Council of Foreign Relations says it'll be here in 2010. And SPP.gov is creating it right now. I'm hard on that case. But if you take a look at what we're doing with Mexico, we're importing so much oil from Mexico, President Bush doesn't dare send back the illegal immigrants. They're sending $30 billion back to Mexico in remittances. It's one of Mexico's biggest businesses. And by the way, we're graciously accepting all their uneducated masses. That leaves all the millionaires and billionaires in Mexico just fine and happy. They don't have to solve their own social problem or share the wealth. And they can stay and live in their own drug-controlled, organized crime-controlled environment You know, I showed in Black, I showed in Minutemen. We know there are Hezbollah cells here. Why? Because some of them are in federal prison. A group of Hezbollah from Beirut bribed Mexican consulate officials and came in through Mexico, went to Detroit, started sending money back. They operated out of a mosque, started sending money back to Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon. We put them in federal prison. Okay, now I make the point there. The only thing unusual about that story, you know, was that anybody had to mention that you had to bribe Mexican officials. It's the only way you can get anything done in Mexico. So the point is, we're finding the next biggest supplier of oil is Venezuela. You know, you don't get, then comes Nigeria. You don't get to Saudi Arabia until about number five and number six on the list. And you mean to tell me that there's oil all around us? There's oil in Venezuela, there's oil in Mexico, there's oil in Canada, but we've run out of it here? Nonsense. There's plenty of oil yet to be drilled at deeper levels that we knew were there to begin with. Our geologists, because they had their mind set in looking for kerogen and source rock, when they got to bedrock, stopped. Brilliant guys. Well, the Russians are now drilling with the Vietnamese off the coast of Vietnam in volcanic bedrock. No living critters that I know of in that volcanic bedrock. And they're finding abundant oil. Our geologists are scratching their heads. They did everything they could to abuse me on writing this book, Black Gold Stranglehold, and telling it to the American people. I went on Coast to Coast AM. Anyone know that show, George Norrie? 4 or 5 hours a night, I'm on George Norrie's show all the time. I just talked to George last night and debated Michael Rupert from, you know, Beyond the Wilderness. He believes in peak oil. We're running out. He thinks that's why we invaded in Iraq. Well, if we did invade in Iraq for the oil, President Bush does need to get his head examined. He may need that anyway. But the point is, there's so much oil, we don't need to fight a war for oil. It's abundant everywhere. And debating Michael Rupert, you know, it was really, he had no idea the science. He was just locked into this, we're running out. Matt Simmons wrote a book called Twilight in the Desert. He said, again, he looked at individual wells, and he said they were at depletion. They were going to be all out. Well, the Saudis said nonsense. Saudis said, our proven reserves are not 280 billion barrels. Our proven reserves are more like a trillion. We've never published the right statistics. The Soviets don't know how much oil they have. I'm sure the Soviets have identified close to a trillion barrels, too. The tankers that we're moving oil with today are the fifth generation of tankers that have sailed the oceans. They're huge. The amount of oil being processed worldwide is unimaginable to the average person. And it's abundant everywhere, except in the United States where we've run out. Okay, now, if you look at what Julian Simon was saying, I believe it's correct. First of all, there was a lot more oil than anybody thought. And even this Hubert's Peak, the guys who continue to believe in this nonsense, keep redrawing it. They're always wrong, and they never admit it disproved their theory. I love how these guys use statistics. No matter what the numbers show, well, they just made an error in calculations. They extend the curve out. The theory was still correct. Okay, so there's much more than we ever thought. And like Julian Simon said, we're never going to use it all. It can't. Why? Well, we are finding it. Our technology now gets it deeper. Oil we didn't think we could recover, we are recovering. 5 minutes, okay. I apologize on questions, but I may take one if I have a couple minutes. Secondly, we're diversifying. We've now used, when I was a kid, the oil fields burned off natural gas. Today, 20 going to 30, growing to 50% of our use of energy in the United States is natural gas. We've learned how to liquefy natural gas. We can move it in tankers. It's abundantly available. Heck, if we run out here, we can just go to Titan and bring it back. Our technology might be able to do it at that point. And also, Julian Simon was right, the innovations are coming on. Innovations that do make sense. Not ethanol, not wind power. The wind power kills more birds than it does anything else. And we'll probably be driving in our cars in nuclear batteries and still have abundant oil. You know, we're not going to be driving in hydrogen anytime soon unless some of the science done on getting the oxygen out of the hydrogen, out of water, is allowed to be brought to the fore. I mean, those were things that have been rumored to be around for a long time. But hydrogen can't be compressed. That's the failure there. We can't compress hydrogen efficiently enough. You'd have to carry around a trailer behind your car to have enough hydrogen to go anywhere. Okay, so in conclusion, what I'm saying to you is that, you know, even the idea of fossil fuel, I'm sorry, but you've all been lied to all your lives. Nonsense. And they still teach it in the university. Our petrogeologists still believe it. And I'm going to continue writing this, and I appreciate forums like this, because I want to continue bringing forward, you know, what the Russians did discover, what others like Thomas Gold advanced, what I'm trying to do in writing and pointing out. I continue to write in Human Events Online and WorldNet Daily. I've written a lot of articles, search both. You'll see I've looked at oil resources all over the world and ridiculed the fossil fuel theory as much as I can by pointing out the alternative science holds up more and it has more validity to it. And like Michael Rupert, they call me a lot of names, but I have yet to see a refutation of the fundamental science of abiotic oil. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Do we have any time for questions? We're going to take 2 minutes of questions. So if anybody has a question and wants to run up there, we'll take them. Okay. Sir, yes?
A couple years ago, I broke down and bought a couple of shares of Swift Energy. They're a family-owned oil company, operate off the coast of Texas. They get a fascinating annual report, and one of their operations is drilling for natural gas successfully in volcanic North Island, New Zealand. Would you care to comment on New Zealand?
Oh, they'll find it. I mean,
they found it. I mean, they're pumping it.
There's plenty there. My favorite on that is the Barnett Shale.
The which?
The Barnett Shale. The Barnett Shale is a shale formation that covers about 11 counties in Texas. Fort Worth sits on it. Well, they thought there was nothing there for decades. The oil geologists abandoned it. Well, some old boy figured out how to fractionalize it, to break it up. In the process, he released the methane out of it. It's got something like 1.28 trillion cubic feet of methane in it, and it's one of our biggest producing methane fields in the United States today, out of solid rock.